representing Lisa Peters is whom? Counsel. Okay, Mr. Rohde, won't you proceed?
Honorable Justices, thank you for this opportunity. This is a case about boundaries, a case dealing with the boundaries of Section 943.50 sub 3 of the Wisconsin statutes, which is immunity for retail merchants in detention of suspected shoplifters. The question that was certified by the Court of Appeals is the question that we addressed in our initial brief. There were additional issues that were then presented by the response briefs. We hope that we have also addressed those issues. This was a case which was dismissed at the trial court level on summary judgment. Basically, the two grounds for dismissal of the case that were expressly stated in the judge's order were, number one, that given the facts of this case, there was no genuine issue of material fact, and that the conduct of the security guards in this case was reasonable as a matter of law. The second prong of the grounds for the dismissal were that the negligence of Mr. Peters was, as a matter of law, greater than the negligence of either API or Menards, and that there was no genuine issue of material fact as to that issue. I think it is critical in evaluating this particular statute and the question which was certified in this case, and that deals with whether a merchant or merchant's employees and agents may be immune from civil or criminal liability under this particular statutory section when their purported detainment of a person suspected of retail theft includes a lengthy pursuit of that person to a place other than the merchant's establishment. We are dealing not only with the four corners of the statutory border, but also geographic borders.
Why?
In this case. The certified question states that...
But we don't have to count, I don't need to be rude. I know what the certified question states, but as soon as I read it, I had problems with that statement of the issue, because I'm not sure that it makes a difference whether the attempted detention and then chase, let's say that it ended in the parking lot of Menards. Does that make a difference?
Your Honor, it's our position that it does. It's our position that when we look at the statute, there are certain acts that are authorized by the statute in order for the security guards to maintain immunity from liability.
So you can chase, according to you, then you can chase the Menards can chase the person, the suspected shoplifter, to the boundary of their property, but once he gets beyond the boundary of that property, they have to stop.
I think that Menards has the responsibility to engage in an attempt at reasonable detainment, an attempt at reasonable pursuit, but the job of chase and pursuit, apprehension and arrest, is that of police officers pursuant to statute. The responsibility of security guards is what is shown in the statute 943.50 sub 3, and those acts that are authorized are reasonable detainment.
So Menards could pursue them up to the boundary of their property.
It would be our position that that would be a reasonable construction of the statute.
I want to stay with Justice Babbage has started, and that is, what is the issue? And I look in part as an answer, perhaps not the exclusive answer, but an answer to the certification memo from the Court of Appeals. And it said at page 3, the question we certify is whether a merchant or merchant's employees and agents may be immune from civil or criminal liability under the statute when their attempt to detain a person suspected of retail theft includes a pursuit of that person to a place other than the merchant's establishment. The certification goes on to then say that the court, if it wants to address that issue, has to give a more specific definition of detain. However, the certification, as I read it, then the next paragraph says, however, essentially saying, you might not want to do that. This is a policy question, if it's not in the statute or the legislative history. And the question might also be answered by allowing the facts of each pursuit to be evaluated by a case-by-case basis using the statutory requirement that a suspect be detained in a reasonable manner for a reasonable length of time. Now, the reason I take the time to read those two sections is I see those as the issues. And the second one being the threshold question. Should we even be addressing the definition of detained, or do we, as the Court of Appeals say, address it on a, decide as a policy matter to address this case on a case-by-case basis using the standard of reasonable manner for a reasonable length of time? Can you respond to whether or not you see that as a threshold issue, or is the only issue that you think that we are to address here being the certified as set forth on page 3.
I think that's an excellent point. I think that the Court of Appeals did raise that issue, that this may be something that is to be determined on a case-by-case basis. Of course, there are facts that can run myriad of just exactly what occurred in a given detainment situation. There are situations where a person is detained within the premises. There is not abuse, physical force, vehement conduct on the part of the person attempting the detainment. There can be situations where a person runs as fast as they can out the front door, across a city street, back through the door of the next business, and back off into the woods. There are situations where an individual can get into a car, go 50 miles an hour through the parking lot, and then go down the street at 100 miles an hour. Is it, in that situation, does this particular statute authorize a security guard of Menards to jump into that person's car, go 40 miles an hour through the parking lot, and 100 miles down the road to chase that individual? Those facts are not necessarily that much different than the facts that we have before us here. We have two individuals that pursued Mr. Peters on a foot chase at a sprint, 10 minutes, nearly a half a mile. The issue is that protected activity under the immunities afforded by this statute. That may in fact be a case-by-case analysis because these cases run the gamut. If an individual is detained 10 feet off the property line of a given business establishment, does that necessarily make not afford them immunity under the statute? Depends upon the facts of the detainment.
So did they, I mean factually then, I understand that the question whether they detained him or not is also a question that's debated here. My other question has to do with you're seeming to say that the detainment has to come within the physical premises. In other words, not outside. That's what you're saying?
Not necessarily. I think that...
Okay, so then it becomes a question of what's reasonable.
Yes.
And each case, as you indicate, stands on this. On its own, and here you're saying it's not reasonable to expect that they would chase it.
Correct. A reasonable detainment may involve stopping an individual as they approach their car in the parking lot. That's certainly outside the four walls of the building and past the last point of purchase.
You talked about physical. Isn't there, as I read the statute, to detain means to stop, to prevent. Are you indicating that if you say stop and the person does not stop, then that's it? What is detainment? Isn't it, can you physically detain someone?
I think, again, on a case-by-case basis, physical detainment can run the gamut. It can go from a hand placed on an individual's shoulder to, of course, the other end of the spectrum in which a person would be put in a chokehold.
Yeah, but here, you know, this is this case, and as we often say, we're writing for not just this case, but a lot of cases involving shoplifting and what would be the result of a pursuit. So at what point are you saying that they should have, that the immunity stopped and the statute does not apply? At what point in this case?
In this particular case, I think that the immunity stopped when the pursuit crossed the road and into the woods and towards the river. And particularly when Mr. Wright and Mr. Kind dove.
Well, I guess what I'm saying, if you chase somebody out of the store and he runs into the street and he's hit by a car, Is that the same as if you chase somebody and he runs into a river or a brick wall? Or
not necessarily. I think, again, that's a case-by-case evaluation, and I think that's an excellent example of something that could in fact occur.
But wouldn't a better public policy be that you read the statute, that one who reasonably detains someone, isn't that the court would say, well, that seemingly is what the legislature wanted for shopkeepers?
I think the statement as to detainment, the one that I would cite, is the Haines v. Shopko case, and that is, we conclude that reasonable manner means the right to detain is no license to use unjustifiable force, physical detention in dark rooms or the like, or ill treatment. Neither is it a license to insult or abuse the customer by excessive vehemence.
And none of that was done here.
That was done here.
Okay. What part of it?
What
running
part?
After him? Chasing?
The number one, I think the interrogation in the parking lot was abuse. I think that the security guard was angry and irritated, as was the testimony of the driver of this truck. We don't know exactly what the conversation was. We probably never will, and there's a reason for that. That's because one of the persons involved is no longer with us. But that's where it began. And it continued. And we don't know. I don't know why Mr. Peters ran, and that's the big question. But he did. Then the chase continued. Apparently, he was yelled to by the security guards. But then we take the next step, and that is the threat of physical violence towards him as he ran away and entered the woods.
But isn't there always a threat? That's what I started with, to detain someone, if it's a simple stop and the person proceeds in or outside of the establishment, then what?
Then if they
don't stop, can the person go further? And
I think that can happen. I think that it is a matter of degree. Again, does an individual as a security guard physically grab another person who is going to the vehicle or leaving on foot and physically drag them down and drag them into the store and put them in a room and do that sort of thing? I do not think that is what is authorized by the immunity under the statute. Reasonable detention, based upon what the case law says, does not include interrogation, and it does not include physical force. It does not include abusive language. It is simply...
But what if, in other words, if they suspect me of being a shoplifter, and they say stop, and they come up to me, they're standing 2 feet from me, and I say I don't want to talk to you, I turn around and leave, they can't stop me?
I think that they can make reasonable attempts to stop you.
What does that mean? I know they can't shoot me, but something short of shooting, what can they do? Can they put their arms around me and restrain me?
I don't think so.
Then how do they stop me?
By moving in front of you and saying, stop, please come with me, we need to question
you. So you would draw the line at no placing on of hands?
Not necessarily. Okay. I think the question you asked me before is wrapping the arms around the body.
Okay. It's what about grabbing my arms? Can they grab my arms? Or my wrists? I'm not trying to trick you, counsel. I'm trying to get
where you're drawing
the line.
I understand the question completely. I think the line has to be drawn at a point in which the potential for any physical harm could occur. And that's on a case-by-case basis.
Mr. Rohde, let me ask you about a couple things you said. At one point you said that there was interrogation in the parking lot. What interrogation was there?
There was approximately a one-minute period of time in which Mr. Wright asked Mr. Peters to step out of the truck. They stood by the side of the truck, and there was this angry and irritated Chad Wright, the security guard, having a conversation with Mr. Peters, at which point, after that period of time, Mr. Peters fled.
How did that amount to interrogation?
I think it goes beyond simply, please come with me. An interrogation, I think, is by definition, a questioning of an individual. And I think that there was an admission that some questioning did occur. I think there was an indication by Mr. Wright that Mr. Peters did not admit to this, and so in fact an interrogation was occurring with respect to whether or not a shoplifting had occurred.
But isn't that standard, counsel? I mean, what in the world would, how would you approach somebody? I mean, it's almost insulting to ask them, did you take something? I mean, is it demeanor we're concerned about? If you're irritated, it goes beyond the line. I mean, that doesn't make sense to me, to have that as some type of level of concern for this court. And it seems to me that the legislature, when they wrote detained, they had to be talking about something more than just standing in front of the person.
The concept of the interrogation and the holding an individual against their will, I do not believe is afforded immunity by this particular statute. The pursue and chase is afforded immunity. Police officers are afforded immunity for that. The job of the security guards in this case is to observe and report and maintain a reasonable detention, but not against that person's will.
Counsel,
the common law was that there was no immunity to merchants for a detention against a person's will. And that's another point that I would like to make regarding the construction of the statute. Statute that is in derogation of the common law needs to be construed very strictly. This particular statute, where there exists a common, the Poitevin versus Wilson case decided by this court in 1983, states that where there exists a common law doctrine relevant to issue presented by the parties and the statute would change the common law, the legislative intent to so change must be clearly expressed. There isn't any word or words in this particular statute that mention detention against will or pursuit or chase or arrest or interrogate. And there's a reason for that, and that's because they weren't meant to be put there.
Let's talk, if we might, about the common law for a minute. It's my understanding that in State versus Lee, the Court of Appeals indicated that the common law did allow merchants to detain suspected shoplifters under certain circumstances. Can you tell us what some of those circumstances were?
Well, in the circumstance of Lee, there was a situation where an individual had a big garbage bag, apparently full of suits, and was walking out through the store. This particular individual, who was a security guard, had never seen that in the previous 8 or 9 years of him working at that location. It was obviously a very strange occurrence to him. He approached the individual, suggested that what was contained in the bag was not necessarily purchased and may in fact have been something from the store, and then in that situation detained the individual. In that case, the detention was upheld as reasonable.
Well, in this situation, it's my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the security guard, Mr. Wright, observed Mr. Peters. He observed him take a drill and apparently put the drill into his basket, and then he observed him go out a carpet department exit without making any payment and went to the vehicle in which he was then asked to step out of and was apparently questioned. Isn't that the kind of circumstance where you'd expect that someone could be detained?
Yes it is. If Mr. Wright reasonably believed that Mr. Peters may have shoplifted an item in the store, reasonable cause.
Under the common law, wouldn't that also have been a situation where there could have been detention?
Yes, and I think the common law allows detention, it just didn't allow detention against the person's will.
Counsel, what's the difference between the privilege of detention and the privilege of arrest? Question number one. Question number two, does the security officer here or officers have the privilege of arrest?
The security officers absolutely do not have the privilege of arrest. The concept of arrest is that a criminal proceeding may be effectuated at some point once that person is taken into custody or actually arrested. That also triggers all of the other criminal procedure that's required to be done at that point, and that is far beyond, I think, a step of reasonable detention. Detention, when we looked at it from the standpoint of the dictionary, I think is maybe a little bit misleading as it would apply to this situation. because the detention does talk about stop and or impede or that sort of thing. The dictionary, when you read that definition, we're not talking about the concept of reasonable detention. We're talking strictly about detained. And in this particular case, the immunities afforded to a security guard are very, very different from a police officer, which include the ability to arrest.
Counsel, your initial statement about premises is a clear, bright line rule that would apply here. The authority to detain stops at the premises, which would include a parking lot and whatever the boundaries are. That's your initial one. The answer to that by opposing counsel, is that isn't what the legislature said. They might have said that in the restatement of torts has that in it, but that's not what they said. Right?
I think that's their position. I think that was a comment, legislative comment.
Now, what about the legislative history here? Does that give any indication of what the intent of the legislature was?
I think that it does. In the previous drafting, the legislature actually had, as a part of the statute, reasonable detention on premises. Now, that is cited by the respondents in their brief, and that does indicate on premises. But again, I guess that gets us back to the issue of the derogation of the common law and the fact that if it isn't in there, it shouldn't be allowed.
Well, you know, I have a lot of trouble with that statutory interpretation rule. Why is the common law so great? The common law was done by judges. Now you've got the legislature who says, we want to change it. Why should this court say to the legislature, oh, we're going to strictly construe the public policy as you have set it forth in the statutes? Sounds to me as it's an anti-democratic rule of statutory interpretation.
I think that the way the statute is written right now, reasonably detain may not be necessarily clear enough for an individual such as a security guard in Chad Wright's situation to make the right decisions in a case like this. Chad Wright was not a police officer, but he acted like one on this day. If the case law associated with this particular statute can clarify just exactly what reasonable detainment is, and the fact that it does not include interrogation, arrest, long chases or pursuits off property, an attempt to do of physical force, or physical force on an individual, I think that helps individuals such as people who are young security guards out there to know just exactly what the law is.
Now, the statute says that the merchant's agent, that the person who's being detained shall not be interrogated or searched against his or her will before the arrival of a peace officer. Suppose there was interrogation. You think that abrogates immunity?
Yes.
So starts asking questions, it's gone.
I think if there's what is considered an interrogation, because it's not an act that's authorized by the statute.
So the only act authorized is to detain in a reasonable manner for a reasonable length of time, and the detention is for the purpose of delivering the person to a peace officer, or if it's a minor, to the parent or guardian. So you can only detain long enough to get a peace officer.
Yes.
Suppose it turns out everybody is busy in town and there isn't a peace officer, and it's going to take an hour and a half to get somebody there.
I think
you detain them?
There are cases, older cases, that suggest a 30-minute detention time. There are cases that we have cited that in which 20 minutes was considered reasonable. I think that, again, that is on a case-by-case basis, but holding a person for an hour and a half and interrogating them, or even not interrogating them, that may not be reasonable. I see my red light is on here.
Red light is on. Are there any other questions? Hearing none, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal, counsel. Counsel?
May it please the court? Mr. Bauer and I have divided our arguments so that I will focus on the issue of immunity under 943.50 sub 3, and he will focus on the issue of the decedent's or the plaintiff's decedent's negligence exceeding the defendant's negligence as a matter of law. Obviously, we're both prepared to respond to your questions concerning either's primary issue.
But I assume you would prefer if we divided in that manner.
At this point, Your Honor, Madam Justice, I'm not sure that it makes any difference to me. But I wanted to focus on some of the things that this court asked Mr. Rohde concerning his position on the case. Is pursuit a part of detaining? Of course it is. It has to be. The pursuit may be as brief as taking three steps out the door and saying, ma'am, would you come back into the store with me? But if a suspected shoplifter runs, isn't it reasonable for that security agent or that merchant or merchant's employee to pursue that person in a reasonable manner? Without having the term reasonable in as a part of the statute, then we would require bright line definitions as to everything that would be required. But here, the statute does not refer to pursuit. It doesn't use the term at all. It doesn't talk about the length of pursuit, but it makes no sense if pursuit isn't the part that's included. Most checkout counters and stores are at the exit. Until the advent of malls, most stores ended at their door, and then you were in either a public street or on somebody else's property. And there are many downtown areas that still are designed in that same fashion. So some level of pursuit is necessary. We must include that term when we say detained. The public policy requirement for this immunity statute is to permit shopkeepers, merchants, to have a reasonable opportunity to stop shoplifting. It's become a problem that's costing us all additional money when we purchase merchandise. There has to be reasonable efforts made by shopkeepers in order to prevent this from occurring. And the statute does not require that the shopkeeper remain on the premises in making those efforts to detain persons. If we didn't have a policy such as this, what would happen would be that shoplifters would flee the premises. It would be they would recognize that a shopkeeper couldn't pursue them. They'd get to the door and thumb their nose at the shopkeeper and walk away. There's a potential for injury to third persons if we got into a situation where shoplifters recognize that by fleeing and getting out the door, getting off the parking lot, they would be free from detainment.
Counsel, what were they pursuing him for? And the sentence in a preposition. What were they pursuing him for?
They were pursuing him. We have the benefit of hindsight in this case, but at the point in time that the security officer pursued Mr. Peters, he did not know whether or not the other two persons in the pickup truck were involved in this situation or not. He wasn't certain whether or not the drill that he'd seen taken from the shelf inside the store was on the person of Mr. Peters, and had no idea what this person's name was.
Now, in this fact situation, I mean, you have a couple of guys and a vehicle remaining, you know, and if we're to assess reasonableness, let me play an advocate and say, well, isn't it reasonable that after it went a half mile and they dove to get him and he was still running, then they just go back and look to see if the drill box, which apparently had a Menards Paid sticker on it, was still in the car rather than in the jacket. And isn't it reasonable for them just to ask the other two people in the car about identity and that information?
And that's precisely what occurred. The facts in this case are as presented by the discovery depositions of Chad Wright and Dan Kine, the two security agents. Mr. Peters, of course, was not available to give testimony. This was a discovery deposition, so counsel had an opportunity to ask whatever questions he did. The fact of the matter was that both Wright and Kind were walking back to the store to see if the pickup truck was there, presumably it still would be, and do those very things that you said, when they heard and saw Mr. Peters down in the floodplain area by the river. The pursuit had already been abandoned before Mr. Peters got into the river. Then they heard him splashing, saw him in the river, and went down and effected the rescue, or attempted to.
Well,
Michael, but wasn't it reasonable, as soon as they saw a car which had a license plate, which can be traced, and two other people, not to even start the chase? Because you've got two people who can identify someone. They can be brought in on subpoena, right? You've got a car that has a license plate. Maybe it's stolen, but license plate can be traced. You can find the owner. You can find out who the owner or lent the car to, or was the owner there. So why, if the standard is reasonable, and let's just accept that some pursuit is needed. And I have to tell you, I'm very sympathetic on that, as the daughter of a shopkeeper on Main Street, Main Street was called Broadway in New York City, as soon as you stepped out of that store, you were in public property, and unless you picked that person up right then, you're gone.
I agree. And
so for some pursuit, okay.
And the question becomes one of when to end it. It's reasonable to assume that as these two security agents followed Mr. Peters across the street, that Mr. Peters would stop. They said stop. And it's reasonable to assume that that would occur. And then Mr. Peters climbed up on the bike trail and started jogging along this bike trail. And it was reasonable for these two people to go up to the bike trail because they knew it was a place of minimal danger.
Why is that reasonable? I don't think it's reasonable for the sake of this argument. Why? Is it because the trial court said it was reasonable?
Well, the trial court did say it was reasonable.
I know.
But the fact is that it would also be reasonable from the standpoint of determining whether or not Mr. Peters had the stolen property on him to procure his identification.
He could have done all that, theoretically, and maybe practically with these other people. Now, you know, this...
If they were still present.
Well, but you see, if you hadn't chased him, you'd have gotten them immediately. If the people from Menards hadn't done the chase, they could have just stayed with what was readily acceptable, a car. Now, let us suppose that the car was then moved and that these other two got quickly into the car and went through the gate. Can the Menard employee, whose car was right there, or the Menard truck right there, if pursuit is okay, can you pursue him with a car?
Well, these are all of the difficult conditions that this court will get into if it starts to draw lines and say, we can do this, but we can't do that. Is the pursuit too long at 3 minutes? Is it too long at 10 minutes? Is it too long at 15 minutes? That's why the reasonable question is there. We have three reasonables. Reasonable ground to believe, and that's, in this case, I think, conceded. The detainment must be in a reasonable manner and for a reasonable length of time.
Okay, but now, what about reasonable length of time. Is the pursuit, you have said that detainment includes pursuit. Now, once you do that, we are on the track of having to make decisions in each case. So, under your view, is it reasonable to pursue with a car?
Under my view, it would be reasonable to pursue in a car, assuming that you conducted yourself in a lawful manner. These people do not have lights and sirens, or there's a statute that suggests how you... And if they were to... If the car was proceeding lawfully, the shoplifter's car, and the security agents got in their car and proceeded lawfully to follow them to get an address, to get an identification, that would be reasonable.
For how long?
It depends upon the circumstances. You know, that's why we can't say that 10 minutes is too long and 9 is okay. We can't put that kind of a burden on security people to give them those types of artificial time limits because it depends upon the circumstances.
So your third reasonable would be reasonable pursuit.
Three reasonables. Reasonable grounds to believe, detain, and I say that includes pursuit in a reasonable manner and for a reasonable length of time.
Oh, okay.
The third reasonable, and reasonable, what's reasonable for a length of time depends, again, on the circumstance.
Counsel, do you agree with the premise that there is a privilege to detain for investigation, but there is no privilege to take into custody?
The statute, the immunity statute, says that you can detain him until a peace officer comes in a reasonable manner for a reasonable length of time. I believe that reasonable manner means you don't put him in a locked, dark room and for a reasonable length of time would be for a period necessary to get a peace officer, a police officer there, and if, as was suggested earlier, there weren't any around, then you would have to interrogate, at least to the extent of getting that.
This is a problem I'm having because they don't have a privilege to arrest. I mean,
they don't have arrest powers.
And arrest oftentimes is defined as the right to take into custody. Where do you draw the line? I mean, an argument can certainly be made that they were pursuing not to investigate, but to take into custody. And where do you draw that line?
I believe that they were pursuing to detain, to take to the store to await the police officer.
To forcibly detain. I mean, there's an argument that diving after him, I assume they were diving to impede his progress and most likely to cause him to fall and stop.
I think they're privileged to contact him. An unpermitted touching is a battery. But I think under this statute, that battery is forgiven or at least immunized by the fact that you have reasonable grounds to believe that this person was a shoplifter.
So diving after him, and if they had made contact, this is hypothetical since they didn't, forcibly taking him to the ground is immune.
If it was determined to be reasonable, if the circumstances were such that made it reasonable.
Is force automatically unreasonable in a detention?
No, only unreasonable force. I have to say something before my time goes up about an issue that relative to the relationship of Menard's and API. Menard's conduct in this case was to make a phone call to the guard shack. That's all. API is an independent security company whose responsibility it is to handle store security. There, if we go back to the basic issue, and I think it was an issue that came out in the Miller case, where is the tort here? What did Menard's do wrong that was tortious? Is it wrong? Is it wrongful conduct or tortious conduct to pursue someone, not contact them, not detain them from the standpoint of an imprisonment, not touch them from the standpoint of a battery? I mean, we didn't have any of that here. All we did was pursue someone, and if there is no wrong in pursuit, then the immunity statute doesn't even come into play. If there was somehow a wrong in chasing someone who took your property, if that's wrong somehow, then the question is whether or not it's reasonable. And if it's reasonable, if you have reasonable grounds to believe, your pursuit and detainment is in a reasonable manner, and you do it for a reasonable length of time, then you do have that.
But do you agree that it's a wrong if the detain was in an unreasonable manner and for an unreasonable length of time?
I know that the case law says that.
Yes. And you don't get immunity, so it looks like a wrong to me when you do that.
So if it's, are you suggesting, Madam Chief Justice, that if it's not done reasonably, then that's a wrong?
That's right, under the statute.
I think that's true from the standpoint, if we got to the point where we made the contact and brought that person back to the store. But I don't think that chasing someone who has your property is wrong.
Okay, let me just ask you this. This is a summary judgment.
Yes.
And ordinarily, summary judgments are not granted when an issue is reasonableness, because that is traditionally a jury or fact question, somewhat mixed, but it's a fact question for the judge. So you've got three reasonablenesses here, and yet you have a summary judgment. Now, for the moment, I will concede to you that this might be an open and shut case on reasonable cause, and therefore you could get a summary judgment on that. But what about reasonable length of time and reasonable manner? You've been unwilling to tell me, when I give you a fact situation, whether it's reasonable or not, and you say it depends. And I think it depends on what the jury says or fact finder says under the circumstances. So, bottom line, how can we justify a summary judgment here at all?
I assume
you may respond, and then we'll hear your co-counsel.
I think the Walmart case suggests that the test is would reasonable people disagree on the reasonableness of the conduct? I don't think reasonable people would disagree on the reasonableness of the conduct in this case.
You think
I think if that's If that's what occurs, then the court, it is a court question and not a jury question.
The test is if there's only one reasonable answer, then you can have a summary judgment, which is another way of saying what you did. And you think there's only one reasonable answer.
And that that was a reasonable,
okay.
Reasonable
answer. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
You did reasonably well, so.
No, I did better than reasonably well. Mr. Bauer.
May it please the court. I am William Bauer. I'm from Madison. I represent API, Advanced Private Investigations. As I understand the issues before this court, my client's positions are completely aligned with Menard's. And so when Mr. Hart and I discussed coming here and presenting our arguments, we thought we would break up the argument as he suggested to you at the beginning. And I think it's important not to lose sight that there is a contributory negligence issue here that did provide the basis for a summary judgment.
Just to clarify, when you say you're aligned, there's not a question here of independent contractors, so Menard is not liable for you and your agents, is that right?
Correct.
So, okay.
Correct. And as I understand, the issues before this court are the issues on the summary judgment, which were contributory negligence as a matter of law and the immunity. And we are clearly aligned on those issues.
But he says even if we hold against you, he should still get off.
He says that. I know that.
And you're not necessarily aligned on that question.
I don't care. At the risk of never getting back to the contributory negligence issue, which I had prepared to talk about, I want to address a couple of things that have come up in the discussion regarding the immunity issue. And first of all, the way the facts have been described, I think, have left a misimpression with the court. The appellant has suggested that this is a 10-minute foot chase that went to great lengths for some long distance. The fact is in the record that my client's agent, said that he took off running after this shoplifter took off running. He ran after him at one point, dove, and that was about the end of his pursuit. His buddy, Mr. Kind, came along and ran by, and he fell. And there was a difference in his testimony whether he was diving to get this guy, Mr. Peters, when he fell, or whether he just tripped and fell. After that point, they stopped. They stopped following Mr. Peters. Mr. Peters continued on his way and eventually found his way to the river and got in the river. My client's agents were completely stopped. They had gone back to the bike path and were essentially waiting. They had sickened of this and had been outrun. The testimony was, Mr. Wright, how much time elapsed from the time that Mr. Peters took off from the parking lot until he was in the river? He said 10 minutes tops. They didn't chase or run after him for 10 minutes. It's not in the record, but the actual chasing and running, we're talking probably 30 or 45 seconds. And then they stopped. And that's all they did. That's all they did.
Well, it took them 35 seconds to chase him. And then they have to get back to the car. Did they walk or run? Or wasn't in that in the record?
They stopped and basically were walking back toward the bike path. They never got back to the car or to Menard's lot because they also were... They were slowed, and they felt that Mr. Peters would probably return in their direction. So they were not in a hurry to go back to the parking lot. And before they could decide, are we going back to the parking lot or not, they hear Mr. Peters in the river, and they go attempt to save his life. So they didn't do either of those things. Another point that was asked, I think, by two of the justices that I think is I'd like to address a little bit more. The question is, well, wouldn't it have been reasonable to just stay in the parking lot? We have a vehicle there with license tags, and we have two individuals in it, and we can certainly talk to them and get all the information we need. And I have several responses to that. The first is, yes, that is reasonable, but it is certainly not required. And for a number of reasons, may not have been the best approach for these security agents. And the flip side of that, I guess, is that if just because they didn't do that doesn't render their other conduct unreasonable, nor does it render their other conduct outside the scope of the immunity statute. The reason that it's... Well, one of the problems with not pursuing Mr. Peters is that they may not get what they want from the guys who were there. They have no reasonable cause to believe those two guys did anything wrong. They cannot detain them at all. If those guys say, don't know, I'm walking away, they can't detain them. Also, it's very likely... Well, there's really a couple of choices here. Those two guys might be co-conspirators. they may not be inclined to give the name of their buddy up. The other side of that is they may not know him. And as it turned out in this case, these are unrelated people who were together because they were at a common job site. And in the construction trades, which these guys were, which are frequenters of places like Menard, frequently tradesmen come and go on a day-by-day basis. These three guys were unrelated. They were sent to Menard to get supplies or exchange or something for the job site. They may not know this guy.
But someone at the job site would know him.
Certainly. You can do an investigation and find it. The purpose of the statute, though, as stated in the court decisions, is to allow merchants to protect their property. And they saw him take a drill in a box. They saw him walk out into the yard, put it in the truck. And when he gets to the gate to leave is when they go out and say, give me the drill. And he denies it. And as Mr. Wright testified, I got sick of hearing his lies. That's what he testified to. So he said, all right, let's go in the store and talk about it. They saw the box still in the truck, but the box was open. He takes off running as soon as he suggests they go in. He doesn't know if the guy has the drill on his person or not. One of their jobs is to protect the property.
Let me just ask you, because we've heard a lot about detention, we've all asked, and I asked opposing counsel, but when you read the statute, it talks the only reason for detaining is to deliver. It talks about it's not to interrogate, it's to deliver that person to a peace officer or his parents, if it's a minor or his guardian. So does that make a difference, because the detention is to deliver that person to a peace officer? Do you think that makes a difference in this case?
A difference how?
Well, as far as the facts, the chase and the... if they're unable to detain, obviously they can't deliver the person to the peace officer. And I think that it would seem to me that the facts would have to talk about what kind of... Where is the police officer? Is he coming? Have they called anybody? Or are they going to call the police officer? You know, we talk about the facts of each case, but the only purpose for detention, as I read it, is a reasonable time, length of time, to deliver the person to a peace officer.
That's correct. And the statute, I believe, also would allow questioning and search with consent.
Yes.
So I would assume that in many of these cases, like people who become detained.
It didn't look like there was going to be any consent here,
well,
did it?
Probably didn't. Yeah. But the purpose of following Mr. Peters was to detain him, was to get him. And there is, since they never even achieved a complete detention, they didn't do anything else. There's no reason to think that the people back at Menard can't be calling the police, which they did.
But what Justice Wilcox, if I'm just going to question, the point he's saying, look, why don't you evaluate reasonable? Your co-counsel says detain means pursuit. So why don't you determine the reasonableness of the pursuit or the reasonableness of the detention by looking at the purpose of the detention? The purpose of the detention is to get this person to a peace officer. So you can do it in a number of ways. If you're saying, you know, chase them. The other way of doing it is saying, okay, if you want to get him to a peace officer, there are other reasonable ways of doing it, and that is to do other kinds of investigation here. And that the test of what's reasonable is to look at getting the information or getting him to an officer.
Right.
And is that, would you say that's the test?
That is what the purpose of achieving a detention is to get him so you can deliver him to a peace officer. And if a person runs, it's not unreasonable to go after him, because otherwise you're powerless. And the purpose of the statute is...
Can you shoot him?
No, of course not.
And the trial court said...
So there is a line somewhere.
Well, of course. What I'm trying to say, and this notion of pursuit, these are steps taken to achieve a detention. Nobody likes to be detained. Nobody likes... You have two choices here with shoplifters. Some are innocent, some are guilty. Usually it's the innocent ones that sue. And if you read the recorded cases, that's what you see. Innocent people don't like to be stopped and accused of shoplifting and detained. Sometimes it will take some measure of force or a show of force to achieve that. Some steps have to be taken. Nobody arrives detained. The guilty people will oftentimes submit because they know they've been caught, but oftentimes will go to greater lengths to avoid apprehension, which is what we have here.
Well, that may not be the only reason because they're guilty. I certainly would not want to be detained, even if I'm perfectly innocent, because I can see the headlines the following morning or the TV stations, and that's the end of that. It doesn't matter whether or not I took it. The damage has been done, so I don't think you can necessarily equate it to guilty. But let's just suppose, change the facts a little. So as the guy is in the store looking for the drill, he sees other things and he says to the salesperson, here's my business card. My name, address, social security number, MasterCard number. If you get in what I'm looking for, call me. Okay. In fact, you can even deliver it and charge me. Now he walks out and there's reasonable grounds to believe he's taken something without paying for it. But there's every reason to know his name. And in fact, I'll make the example even more ridiculous. He drops all of his business cards in the pursuit. So now you know who he is. I mean, maybe it's not he. Maybe he's got a false business
card. He might drop somebody else's business cards.
That's right. He may have. There are hundreds of them. Okay. So should you pursue him? Or have you already gotten, if you're going to do the purpose, you've got enough to deliver him to a peace officer?
You can pursue him. The statute and the legislature has said you have the right to detain him, not just find out who he is. You have the right to detain him. Whether that's the best course of action or whether that might lead to some other disaster, you see each situation as it goes. But you have the right to detain the person. Detain the person. That's my response.
Would you agree that that you can pursue as long as there's no potential for physical harm? That was the standard your opposing counsel gave.
I believe probably so. I mean, any fact situation can carry to an extreme, but if there's no potential or reasonably foreseeable potential for physical harm to the suspect, then I don't see what would be unreasonable about continuing to follow him in an attempt to detain him.
We've asked you questions and I'm guilty. You haven't gotten to what you wanted to talk about with tributary negligence, and your point is that his going into the flooded waters is more than negligent than you're pursuing him, if you were negligent at all.
Right, and because we're here as a result of a summary judgment, all the issues were never presented. We could have moved for summary judgment saying, where's the negligence? There's not even any provable negligence here. We chose not to do that for a number of reasons, but we did assert the two that we succeeded on in the trial court, and those are what's being appealed here. The contributory negligence is extreme. We have a person who has not been threatened, is not being threatened, is not even being followed at that point on his own, who decides to get into a river that he can't swim across. And in fact, he made it all the way across, but then was unable to get out before the current took him again. That's in the record.
Well, he was threatened with detention, wasn't he?
Legal detention?
Yes, he was.
I mean,
concerned
he in his
about
mind,
that.
He got in the river. The only reasonable inference is that he wanted just to get away, to complete his getaway, to avoid all apprehension.
Counsel,
and it's. I mean, it's mind-boggling.
Is your position then that there is a privilege to detain as long as the three reasonableness tests are met? That normally three reasonable tests would not be subject to summary judgment. Normally it would be a question or questions for the jury to decide. That is, the privilege to detain is circumscribed only by reasonableness. However, in this particular fact situation, as a matter of law, negligence outweighs, of the plaintiff outweighs the defense. Is that your position?
Basically, yes. The plaintiff is entitled to all reasonable inferences from the evidence when we're in the position of a summary judgment motion.
And normally, since reasonableness is the standard here, normally it would be a jury question. The privilege of immunity, whether or not they have a privilege of immunity, normally would be a jury question.
As would the comparison of negligence would normally be a jury question. But under these facts, which are extreme, we believe that the judge was correct in ruling that this plaintiff was contributory negligent as a matter of law, in excess of what anyone else could be, and the judge also determined that the conduct of my clients, given the plaintiff the benefit of all doubt, was reasonable. See, my red light is on, so I will take my leave without having said much of what I wanted.
But you've done it in good spirit, counsel. Mr. Rohde.
Thank you. As to the one issue that was raised on the relationship of API and Menards, the argument that Menards didn't do anything wrong here, well, I think negligence is an act or an omission. And in this case, I think we're looking at an omission. Menards has a duty to the whole world. They have a duty to their customers. They have a duty not to engage the services of a supposedly insulated third-party security company to do a terrible job of trying to secure the premises and to chase people all over town. Menards can't simply stand back, employ a third party to handle their security, and wash their hands of it. That is the claim of negligence in this case. The store manager was involved. Mr. Wright went to the store manager. The store manager called the gate in order so that the police would be called. Wright and Kind never should have taken off. That should have been Menard's instruction to them, if nothing else, and they simply can't wash their hands of that. As far as reasonable inferences in this case, they talk about a 35-second maybe chase or something less. The testimony from a neutral, credible third party, the investigating police officer, stated that the chase, where it was described to him by Mr. Wright and Mr. Kind, was of a half mile in duration. That's a long ways. That's not a 35 or 40 or 1 minute chase. Now, maybe the entire chase took 10 minutes, but that is very significant. Is that reasonable? I can't imagine that wouldn't be a jury question.
Counselor, can I just ask you, is there any other exit except through the river, the water? I mean, is there another way of his having fled? Could he have gone to a highway? Could he have gone somewhere else?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that if he did, he would have had to have come back up towards the roadway. I think he was bound by the river. The other reasonable inference is this. It is argued, unfortunately all the testimony comes from the defendants in this case, but it is argued that they gave up their chase and their pursuit, and then at some point after that, Mr. Peters jumped into this river to swim across. Why would he have done that if they had given up their chase and they were a distance away, and we are talking about the La Crosse River, May 5th of 1994.
Wasn't the testimony that they gave up their chase, but they were trying to observe him? In other words, see where he went?
I think that's what their testimony was. They gave up their chase. They did, in fact, observe him enter the river. Now, this being a wooded area, I think reasonable inferences a jury could derive from this would be that their chase didn't necessarily end at a distance from Mr. Peters. The jury could derive reasonable inferences that maybe this chase ended just as they were about to grab him next to the river. And so I think in viewing this case in a light most favorable to the party against whom the motion was brought, and also utilizing reasonable inferences, not simply just the evidence, and I think reasonable inferences are critical in this case, that's an important point. The other key that was mentioned is
do you think
detainment.
A summary judgment should be entered for you?
No.
You want to go to trial?
Yes.
Okay.
In order, the detainment, as was mentioned before, is to deliver that person to a police officer. This is not the Wild West. It is argued that the conduct in this case was reasonable. They would have had Brian Peters to a police officer or agency within 1 day rather than in a casket in 1 day. As far as the contributory negligence in this case, reasonable inferences. If Brian Peters had not been threatened, he would not have tried to swim across a river. If he had not been in fear of his safety or of his health, he would not have tried to cross the river. I think a jury would look at this case, and I think it's up to a jury to determine all of the facts and circumstances given the reasonable inferences. And then finally, I heard the phrase stated by counsel that Mr. Wright said, "I got sick of hearing his lies." That occurred, supposedly, out in the parking lot after this 1 minute interrogation. That's very indicative of what was going on in the situation. Mr. Wright interrogated, charged, and convicted Mr. Peters within 1 minute in his mind. And he had no business